teaching Sunday school, not hardly. I'm Judy Pearson. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody. This has been lovely. I'm going to start like the other speaker started, of course, and thank everyone who was responsible for getting me here and pray that I get home. I understand Charlotte's ice, and I'm supposed to go and have a pit stop at Charlotte, and I might not get there tonight, but you know, it always works out. It always works out. So that goes into God's hands, and this is a wonderful place. I was here many, many years ago at this very conference. I spoke here and some of you may have been here, but back then I was about a size 9, so if you don't recognize me, that's quite all right. There are a couple things that, you know, when you quit smoking, all these sweet people will tell you, well, you'll put on some weight, but it'll come off. They lied to me. But that's all right. You know, I don't smoke anymore, and that's good. If they came up with one that was safe and that wouldn't be offensive, I'd go out and buy a carton right now. I loved them right to the last one, honey. I puffed on those things for years. But, you know, I had a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous who had a philosophy, and I've kind of adopted it in my life, even in my sober life. And his philosophy was, if you can't get addicted to it or obsessed with it, it's not worth doing. And that's kind of the way I was, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful fellowship, and it's conferences like this that bring us that joy. It's been so good for me this weekend because I've seen some of my good friends from Atlanta, some people I've known for many, many years from Atlanta, and Atlanta's a city I got sober in, and that's important to me because as you get older in Alcoholics Anonymous, there begins to form a bond with people, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you see them every week or whether you only see them once every 5 years, you're just so glad to see them again and glad to see that they're still sober. And I've been able to see that with some folks this weekend. John Cornelius, I saw him the first day I got here. I went to a meeting, and it was nice to see John. I've known John many years, and John Holmes, and I have to tell you that John and Mary Emma both. See, John Holmes knew me when I wasn't teaching Sunday school. You know? And I must say this because it brought tears to my eyes when I thought of you the other day. John always treated me like a lady, even when I wasn't one. And I am grateful to you for that, my friend. I thank you for that. Because, you see, I didn't bring a lady to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just simply didn't. And so there's been a lot of change here. And, you know, and as Bill sees it, it says that if we want permanent sobriety, that there has to be a profound personality change. And I must tell you that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, there has been a profound personality change. I will tell you, too, that I am one of those alcoholics who came into Alcoholics Anonymous 1 week before Christmas in the year of 1972, and I haven't had a drink since. It was my first meeting. And you're applauding yourself, by the way, when you do that, so I thank you, but really you're the ones that are responsible for that. And I bring that up only because I want anyone to know that may not have a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you do not have to go back out to be a member of AA. You can come in here and stay sober from the very first meeting. Relapse, as some call it now. We used to call it getting drunk, but if you want to call it relapse... is not necessary. It is not a prerequisite to permanent sobriety. You can do it from the get-go, baby, and I know. You know? I remember when I came in, one lady was, a sweet, dear lady, and she said, Judy, you really must have wanted to get sober to come in a week before Christmas. You know? And I'll tell you the truth, folks, had I known it was a week before Christmas, I probably wouldn't have come. I didn't know. You know, I didn't know. I just knew I'd had it. I just had it. I believe that what our big book tells us is very, very important about, you know, that we disclose what we were like and what happened and what we're like now. But because sometimes when I talk, some people are a little bit offended, I guess you might say, because I'm not real concerned about being politically correct and, you know, making it sound real nicey-sweetsy because my alcoholism wasn't nicey-sweetsy. I'm going to share something for you that is in the big book that I like to read periodically to remind myself what I'm supposed to be doing up here. I will not give you the page number. I'm one of those people who believe if you want to know where it is in the book, you read the book till you find it. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. See, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to meetings like this and conferences like this for 6.5 years, waiting to hear my story. Absolutely. And nobody should have to wait that long. So I don't clean up my story. You see, my story is one of those, I came from an alcoholic home. My mother married an alcoholic after she divorced my father. I was about 5 years old. She married an alcoholic. He was in the early stages of alcoholism. And he was a wonderful man. He was a wonderful man until the booze became so much a part of our life. And to cut through all the nightmares and all the horrors that go along with being raised in an alcoholic home, I will just tell you that I was the abused child in the home. I was the one that was beat up. I had broken noses. I had cracked ribs. And this nonsense started when I was about 12 years old and went on to my teen years. I was also sexually abused. And that just was the way it was in my home. You know, I had a lousy childhood. I did not have a good childhood. I never knew what was going to happen. You know, I knew what it was like to be in a house and you not know who's going to be picking themselves up off the floor next. I think it's important for me to remember that I was the one that was always in the middle of the things. You know, I have two sisters, and my two sisters cut out, man. When this stuff started, they had sense enough to get out of Dodge. But not me, because I'm going to fix it, right? I'm going to be in the middle of it. And so when he would go and start slapping my mother around, I'd be right in the middle. You know, and I guess I was about 14 years old, and I went to stop a fight, and he decided he wanted me out of the way, and he hit me, and I bounced off the wall, and I got up, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to put up with this stuff. And I started hitting back. And I can remember that first punch I threw. I can remember. And I can remember it hitting him on the jaw, you know. And I can remember thinking, God, that felt good, you know. It was just, and I was one of those, see, that's why to me, my speaking on Sunday morning is really just something else. Because I told one lady I was talking to here at the conference that she had to be here Sunday morning because this was really going to be spiritual. But it just absolutely amazes me. See, I wasn't one of those ladies that sat at home and drank. I was a barroom brawler. I was one of those gals that I fought. I didn't take any crap off anybody. I walked around with a chip on my shoulder. I was cold, and I was hard, and I was bitter when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was just waiting for you to ask me something I didn't want to answer. You know, I had a chip on my shoulder when I got here. And that's the way it was for me. And I got through high school, and I don't know how I got through high school. And now, because I was drinking, I took my first drink at the age of 10. And that's another thing. I loved alcohol, even at age 10. You know, and most kids don't like booze at the age. I loved it. I just loved it. And it just did everything I needed to have done. You're not going to hear me talk about drugs, and it's not because I'm one of those people who say you shouldn't talk about drugs and Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just not my thing. But it's because I didn't take them. It's because I didn't need them. You see, alcohol did for me everything I needed to have done. Absolutely everything. I can promise you that if it did not work, I would have found something that would have taken me where I wanted to go. You know, something would have gotten me where I wanted to go. I also believe that alcohol absolutely saved my life. I believe alcohol saved my life. I could not have coped in my teenage years with what was going on in my life had I not had something to numb it and take it away. And alcohol took it away. Absolutely took it away. You know, and I'm a child of the 60s. Isn't that a wonderful thing to say? Isn't that great? You know, the clothes in the 60s were enough to keep you drunk. You know, it's just... And there was a lot going on. There was a lot going on, as most of us know. There was a lot going on in our country in the 60s. And I was one of those folks that everything, somehow, I should have been able to do something. I should have been able to do something about the Vietnam War. I should have been able to do something about the way our guys were being treated when they came back home. I should have been able to do something about the race riots. Because all of it was painful. All of it was painful. So I drank. I drank. No. I was also one of those women, and I can tell by looking at the ladies that we have here that probably none of you ever did this, but I used to pick up men in bars, believe it or not. You know, I was one of those gals, and I had my bars that I frequented, and I knew the guys, the ones that, you know, hey, that's bad news, or I've already been with him and forget it. But I was one of those who sat on the stool and looked at the guys that came in, you know, and sized them up. And I've heard guys talk about this. I sized them up and thought, well, you know, this might be the one. This might be Prince Charming. This might be the answer to all my problems. No. And like I say, I knew the bars. So typically I picked on the newcomers that came in to our bars. And I'd take them home. And typically, you know, they'd stay a couple hours, maybe overnight, rarely longer than that. And and that was the way for me. After I graduated from high school, I had a nice little job, but it was still one of those things. Every night I went to the bar. You know, I drank, did most of my drinking. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 23, so legally I only drank 2 years legally. but alcoholically I drank 9. And it just amazes me when I think about how quickly I fell, how quickly I went down, how difficult life became for me so fast. I am very grateful for that. I am very grateful that 9 years I was able to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, these guys would be coming in and out of my life, and you know, eventually somebody would fall in love with me, which can be a real encumbrance when you want to drink. And they would say things to me like, you know, it's either me or the booze. You're going to make a decision, because I'm not staying in your life if you're going to keep drinking. And I'd say goodbye. Because it was fine with me. I didn't care if you stayed in my life. You know, you were not going to take out of my life the only thing that made my life bearable. I wasn't going to have it. Drinking was it. You know. Now, I don't want you all to think by any means that I was raised by a family that absolutely had no morals or anything. I wasn't. My mother was very loving and very kind and put up with an awful lot from me in my years of active alcoholism, and actually a good bit after I got into the program. You know, but I knew right from wrong. I had a grandmother as a little girl, and my grandmother was a very, very strong Catholic Polish woman, and she was only about 4'9" and just about the same width as she was height. But she walked into a room and she commanded respect. She absolutely, her charisma, everything, you automatically loved and respected her. And as a child, I feared her, and back then that was okay. Kids could fear their grandparents, and if you had my grandmother, you'd fear her too. But a loving woman. You know, so I was taught those things that was right from wrong. I was taught that you don't live the way that I was living. I knew all those things. And that's when we go into the nightmares of alcoholism for me, and every alcoholic in here, and every Al-Anon in here, by the way, knows what those nightmares are. You know, the living the way you don't want to live. And getting up the next day and saying, why did I do that? And promising yourself and the people about you that, yeah, you know, I won't do this anymore. I'm going to get my act together, you know, and I'll be all right. It'll just, if only this would get in shape, and when this gets in shape, and I'll be okay. And my mother would worry, and I'd look at her face, and I'd see that worry in her face, you know, and I'd want to take it away from her, because she'd look at me as only a mama can look at you, you know. And you see the concern in their eyes and the disappointment, and you want to take all that away, and you know that the drinking's at the bottom line of that. You know that. Intuitively, you know that. And as our other speakers have said, you really want to say. When you say it, you really want to believe that's what's going to happen, and you really want to try and do that. But then all of a sudden, something comes up, and you got to take that one drink, and it's off to the races all over again. It's the same thing. It's going back to the bar and picking up another guy, you know, and it's getting up in the morning and trying to go to work, and you can't go to work. You just can't go to work. And I loved what one of the speakers said about, you know, if most people woke up the way we did, they'd be in ICU. You know, and it's true, because I can remember getting up in the morning, and there is nothing more difficult than trying to put eyeliner on when you got a hangover. Man, it ends up in your eyebrows. It's just a mess. And try and get up and go into work. And eventually, of course, you know what happened. I couldn't go to work anymore. You know, and this is when I picked up these guys, by the way, and not to clean up my story here at all. Sometimes they would stay a while, you know, a couple of months, and that worked out real convenient because they could get me back on track financially. You know, I'd have them get the bills caught up, and I'd have them get things straightened out for me and get the groceries back in the pantry and that kind of thing. And then they'd come up with the it's either me or the booze speech, and they were gone. You know, and then I'd wait again till I was running out of money and I was running out of food, and then I'd bring somebody else in. And that's how it was for me. You know, I just didn't care. I just really didn't care. And we do that. We do that as alcoholics. We keep telling ourselves we just don't care. You see, because if you keep cutting off that, you don't want to hurt, you don't want to feel the pain, so you just keep telling yourself you just don't care. And the tragedy of doing that is eventually you don't. Eventually, you buy your own stuff, and you don't. No. And that's what gets scary. You don't care about the hurt and the pain you're causing others. I was working for Riches for a period of time, and I did real well on alcoholics. We do, you know, we fall upstairs. We're real good about doing that. And I did a lot of my achieving, so to speak, because I wanted to prove to you that there wasn't anything wrong with my drinking. I didn't want to do it because I wanted to be a success in life. I was going to prove to all of you that I could drink the way I want to drink and still be a success. And I couldn't do it. At 21, when I got to be legal age, I went into the bar and restaurant business. And that's probably what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous at 23. Because there was a lot of liquor there, there was a lot of men there, there was a lot of low life by the time I finally got to the program. And my drinking just was out of control. Just absolutely out of control. I was getting in a lot of fights, and I don't know how many of you got in fights, but you know, sometimes those bruises, there is no makeup that will cover them. So you have to take off work. You have to stay home 3 or 4 days because you got a cut lip, and it's, you know, I don't care how much ice you put on it, it's not going to go down, and it looks bad. And so you just have to stay home until you get well. And when you do that, and you're a waitress, and a cocktail waitress is what I did, tips were my living, and of course I was running out of money. And I was sick. I was very sick. I weighed about 85 pounds because all I did was eat, and usually my cuisine consisted of peanut butter crackers or something, you know, because you don't want to eat a regular meal. I mean, you get a good buzz going. Certainly, heaven forbid, you don't want to ruin that with a decent meal. You know, you've got a lot invested in that drunk. I mean, you just simply can't eat and waste it all. So I didn't eat much. And of course, you never sleep when you're an alcoholic, do you? You pass out, but you don't sleep. And even at the age of 22, I was very ill, and I was having many problems. I'd already gone upon the advice of one of my fiancés. There were three during this two-year period, and two of them at one time, which makes for real exciting living. And you know how you get confused when you're drinking? You know, days kind of cross over one another. And both of those engagements ended on the same night when I invited them both over for dinner. You have no idea how surprised I was when the second one showed up. And I was grateful there was a back door. I just kind of left the apartment and let the two of them work it out, and I went down and... As the drinking got worse and I got feeling worse about myself and I got feeling to where I just really didn't care, I called a guy that I had met in the bar and restaurant business because I couldn't pay bills anymore. And the sugar daddies were staying away now, you see, because really I was scary is what I was. I had this fondness for knives, and when I got angry, I would reach for a knife. And people were scared of me. I can remember sitting at a bar one night drinking, and you know, they had the mirrors in the back of the bar. You can watch yourself drink. And there were two guys behind me, and one guy was going to hit on me, and his friend pulled him aside and said, "Don't mess with that one, man. She's crazy. That woman will slice your throat." And he was right. He was right, because I would do it. I was so angry. I was so angry, and I was so eaten up with self-pity, you know, about what had happened to me as a child and the engagements that broke off. And it just, my life was just pathetic, you know. And so I would wallow in that self-pity. And so the sugar daddies were no longer. People just stayed away from me, which in essence is what I wanted, because I wanted to be able to drink in peace. I didn't want anybody bothering me. I didn't want anybody insisting I had to change. I just wanted to drink in peace. Just leave me alone. Let me drink in peace. And as I was going downhill and I couldn't make ends meet and I was getting sicker and not able to show up for work, I had to do something, and I knew I had to do something, and I called a guy I met in the bar and restaurant business and went to work for him as a whore on the streets of Atlanta, because that's what I had to do. I had no choice. I didn't know what else to do, you know. And it just didn't matter anymore. You know, the fact that it was wrong and it was the most despicable thing a young woman could do just didn't matter anymore, because it's what I had to do. It's absolutely what I had to do. And, you know, sometimes even an Alcoholics Anonymous, believe it or not, when I say that, I can look out over the audience and see some looks of disdain and non-approval. You know, like, oh, my, 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 how could you think that low? You know, and my question, I often wonder, you know, how many of us prostituted ourselves in one way or another? You know, and let me tell you something else, too, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart. My biggest critics are usually the women who didn't have sense enough to sell it, or the men who had to pay for it. So. I'm glad you all agree with me on that. I really am. You see, because you have absolutely no idea what kind of shame goes with that. You have absolute, and you don't know how hard it is to come in and see all of you so nice and so clean and so decent. And you want to stay sober, and you're thinking to yourself as a young woman, but my God, if they only know, they won't let me stay here. They won't let me stay here if they know. You know, they'll throw me out. And when I talked to you about coming to meetings for 6.5 years, 6.5 years I came to meetings like this, speakers' meetings, waiting for another hooker to show up. You know? Waiting for one more. And it's 6.5 years I had to wait. And when I finally heard her, I made a promise to myself that I will never get behind a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and clean up my story to make it nice for some sanctimonious soul out there. I will not do that. You know, it's nice. And, you know, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we clean up on the outside. We clean up on the outside, but I am so very grateful to my sponsors. So very grateful that they told me, do not forget where you came from. Do not forget. Because if you forget where you came from, you're doomed to go back. You are doomed to go back. You know, because it's nice. This morning, I got up, I got dressed in a beautiful hotel on a beautiful island. You know, but when I came to you people, it was some flea bag Alamo Plaza on the south side of the city. And I have to remember that. I absolutely have to remember that. And that becomes, too, one of the greatest tools I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because no matter how bad my life gets in sobriety, no matter how bad it gets, I don't have to wake up at the Alamo Plaza with somebody I don't know anymore. No matter how bad it gets. You know, and that keeps me grateful. That keeps me grateful. Now, even in that profession, people, you got to be able to walk. And after a while, I couldn't do that. I would try and get up, and I was so sick, and I was so weak, and I hadn't eaten, and I would try, and I just could not get up. And then the mind started, because, you know, I'd already gone through convulsions and seizures as a result of my drinking. And I mean, it just kind of got to where I knew what was happening, and I knew why it was happening. And it was just the price she paid, you know, when you drank the way I did. It was just the price she paid. And I was a daily drinker. I didn't see any reason in taking a couple of days off. I just couldn't bear it, you know. I could not stand sobriety. I couldn't stand sobriety. I didn't know how to deal with life. I didn't know how to deal with people. I couldn't fit in, didn't want to fit in. I couldn't deal with all these demons that went on in my head when I tried to get sober. I just couldn't, with the paranoias, and I just couldn't handle it. So I just preferred to stay drunk. And when you prefer to stay drunk, those things happen to you physically. When you don't eat, those things happen to you. And I called my mother one night, and I was absolutely out of my mind, and she came over and got me. Somehow, through a series of events, which I simply don't remember very well, I ended up in a hospital. And it was not for alcoholism. It was because they thought I was a little crazy. Which was true. I was a lot crazy, actually. And they put me on a ward at a state hospital, and they put me there for being suicidal, homicidal, and both were true. And that's really kind of frightening when I look back at it now, don't you know, because I had no respect for life, period. And I really didn't care if it was you or me that ended up dead at the end of the fight. I really didn't care anymore. And that's frightening. That's frightening. You know, and that's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's amazing to me. That is absolutely amazing to me. It is frightening to think that I was clinically diagnosed as being suicidal, homicidal, that a shrink had actually told my mother she has no respect for life at all and we need to put her away, that this same shrink told me, you know, that I was of danger to myself and to society. That's frightening. And this is the person you got leading your Sunday morning meeting. It's incredible. It is absolutely incredible. I stayed there 6 months. I wasn't getting any better. They put me on some pills to keep me from hitting the other patients. You know, and do you really, and it's not that I didn't try. Have y'all ever been on Miller-Roll? Well, if you're on that stuff, you can still throw a punch. It just takes 20 minutes to get there, you know? It's just, it's like the whole world moves in slow motion. It's just, so, and I didn't like being there, and I couldn't get drunk as often as I wanted to get drunk, even with the pills. They weren't the same, you know, because I wanted out. Pills didn't take me out, and I wanted out. I didn't want to remember. I didn't want to think. I wanted out. And they didn't take me there. And of course, we are very good cons, aren't we? And I was able to con. After I threw that punch at that gal, I was able to con my shrinker. And I became a very good patient and did all the things they wanted me to do. And we can do that. We're smart that way. We really are, you know. And I said all the things they wanted me to say, and I talked to all the counselors they wanted me to talk to, and I did the right things. I went to decoupage, and I worked out at the gym and all that stuff that they want you to do, you know. And sure enough, the con worked very well, and I was able to get a 3-hour pass. He wouldn't give me a full weekend pass, you know, because heaven only knows what I'd do to society if I was out there a whole weekend. So they only gave me a 3-hour pass, and that was in November of 72, and I'm still out on that pass, so. And, you know, I think it's wonderful because you all knew it was coming, and he never knew what hit him, you know? He just, because you would have done the same thing. You know, you're staying in a place, and they're locking the door at night, and you can't go anywhere, and you can't get out, and so you got to do the best you can to get out of there. And I did what I always did, when I wanted to run away. I made arrangements with a guy that I had been seeing on and off for a couple of years, and he met me at the big gates of that hospital, and we got in that car, and he had 2 quarts of black velvet and 2 cases of Miller High Life, and we were off. And I woke up somewhere in the south side of town, and 10 days later. And I still had the same clothes on that I had when I left the Institute. And I could tell you that I probably didn't let anybody in that room. I can remember how bad that place stank. And I don't know how I got over to my mother's, but my mother came home that day from work to find her 23-year-old daughter passed out on her couch. 10 to 14 days without a bath or a change of clothes and stinking from booze and sleeping with men. And that's what she found. And that's alcoholism to me. See, that's the dehumanization that goes along with alcoholism. That's the, you know, where you're not much more than just a sick animal. And that's where I was. And, you know, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous talk to us about making amends. And I'm a big believer that amends are simply not saying, well, you know, I'm sorry I did that, Mom. Sorry I came home one more time and passed out in your house. Sorry I came home one more time drunk and brought a guy home to your house. I'm sorry. That's not what the amends are to me, no. Amends to me are a living process. Amends to me are, I am the best daughter I can be on a daily basis. I listen to Mom. I care about my mother. I try and be a good daughter because I feel like I owe her that. She put up with crap from me forever and ever and ever, with lies, with stealing, with breaking her heart time and time and time again. And to me, I'm sorry is not going to cut it. You know, it means that when Mom calls me and she wants to talk to me about her little dog that she just took to the groomers and the color of polish they put on its nails, I will listen and delight with her. That's what that means. No. And it means when she calls me and she's going to tell me all about the dinner that she fixed for Thanksgiving Day and give me the recipe for everything that she cooked, I am going to sit there and listen and enjoy hearing about it. No, because that's how you make amends to me. That's how you make amends. You know, and if you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will tell you to simply say that you're sorry is not enough. No, there are other things that I hear in the program today that are not enough. I heard somebody say one time in a meeting that if your family does not get in recovery, you'll never make it. Well, let me tell you, folks, if I'd waited on my family, I'd still be drunk or dead. No, I was the one that drank alcoholically. I was the one that went through everybody's life like a tornado. Not my mother, not my 2 sisters. I did. You know, and I'm the one that's going to have to get well. And I came in at a time when sponsors told you you could get well. You know, and you know what? That's in the book, too. We have recovered, is what it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have recovered. You know, isn't that wonderful? And you know, now that I'm in my preaching mode here, this is something I want to share with you. And this is a personal thing, and if you don't agree with it, really, I still love you. It doesn't matter. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the end of the Lord's Prayer was amen. That was the end of the prayer. It wasn't this keep coming back, it works if you work it, but you got to work it every... Damn it, amen is the end of the Lord's Prayer. And I, the committee asked me not to use profanity, so I apologize for the damn it, but I feel better. Thank you. And I tell you, there was something beautiful about that. There was something nice, because there was just a few seconds of silence. And it was like, you know, you stood there and you were quiet, and God kind of smiled down on you, you know? It was really, I liked it, but it's my thing, so you do whatever you want to with it. Yeah, so I'm back at that hotel, right? And I'm, God only knows who all I've been with, and it doesn't matter, it's irrelevant now. And I get back to Mom's, and I try suicide again, and I get to another shrink, and he says, you know, I got to go to group therapy, which is, well, I just told him what he could do with group and therapy, and I walked out. And I went over to my cousin's, who was the only person in the world who would even let me in her home, and she was going to fix me. God love her. She'd read a lot about alcoholism and knew how to handle us, and inside of 3 weeks, she had said, you got to pack your bags and go. I've never seen anybody drink like you, ever. And I was very bitter, and I was very cruel to her, and I went, so to speak, verbally for the throat, and my mouth was horrible, people. I used language that was just, it was terrible. It was awful. And then for some reason I just stopped, and I told her, you know, I don't need you and I don't need anybody else. I'll go. I don't need to stay here. And I remember walking to that door and looking out there, and it was, like I say, December, and it was cold in Atlanta, and I thought, where are you going to go, girl? Where are you going to go? You got no place to go. You have burned up, used up, beat up everybody that's ever been in your life. You have no one to call. And so I was 23 years old, and, you know, my mother threw me out of her home. Where else am I going to go? Where else am I going to go? And I can remember when Mom threw me out. I can remember how angry I was at her and the terrible things I said to her. And where was I going to go? And I asked her to call AA. I asked my cousin to call AA, and she did. And I didn't do that because I was not, you know, I wanted somebody to do for me that, which I could not dial the phone. I don't know how y'all were, but when I was coming off a drunk, I shook horribly. And back then, we had the little, you had to stick your finger in a thing, you know. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. So she called for me. And I remember Elsie, I think Helen, was at our central office then. Elsie answered the phone, and she asked me, she said, how you doing, honey? And oh, my God, what a sweet voice this lady had. And just so nice sent to me, you know. And it had been a long time since a woman had talked nicely to me. And I told her I thought I was dying, and she asked me if I thought I could go till 7 o'clock that night without a drink, and I said, I don't think so. And that was a long time. This was like 10 in the morning. That was a long time to go without a drink, and the shakes were already setting in, and she said, well, just try, do what you can. And she said, drink some orange juice and honey. And I said, that's not going to happen. I can tell you right now, there's no way I'll be able to drink orange juice. I mean, first of all, it's good for you. Secondly, it's not going to stay on this stomach. I just not. And so I just kind of paced, and my cousin, really an odd thing, she fixed me a drink, and vodka, of course, you know, nobody could smell it, and I took that drink, and it was a good one, and it seems to me like it was around noon that I took that drink, and it calmed the nerves, and the lady said something about eating candy or eating honey, and I ate a lot of honey that day. I was able to eat some honey to keep the shakes from going down. I was real afraid of going into seizures and convulsions again. And I didn't do it that day, and I got to go to that meeting that night. And it was wonderful. My cousin Joanne helped me bathe. I started getting dressed at like 4:30 because I was not a well person. And she had to put me in the tub and help me bathe. And then she gave me some decent clothes to wear because I didn't have decent clothes to wear. I didn't know how y'all dressed in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I just intuitively knew that leather was not going to be the mode of dress. So she let me have a nice little lady-like kind of thing to wear, you know, a pantsuit kind of thing, and that was great. And the folks came to do the 12-step call, and the first one to walk in was one of the best-looking men I had ever seen in my life. Absolutely glorious, and men were my second addiction at that time. And he really was, and I still think he was one of the most beautiful men I ever saw. He was tanned and a little bit of gray at the temples and had on a blue sweater, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous right that second, you know. But right behind him, folks, came Rebecca Sunnybrook Farm. I remember her so well. Her name was Bunny. And I remember I was so frightened somebody was going to find out I was going someplace with some broad named Bunny. And she was a little lady. She truthfully was a little lady, and she dressed like a little lady. And here again, the odd thing was that she was so very kind to me. And as we were walking out of the apartment, and we were walking on that first step, and it was cold, and we had had a little bit of ice there in Atlanta, and I was not walking very well. I remember her reaching over and grabbing my arm so that I would not fall because I was shaking so bad, and I pulled away from her, and looked her right in the eye, and let her know, don't you touch me. Don't touch me. And I remember the softness of her smile, and I remember her saying, I just didn't want you to fall. And y'all been holding me up ever since. And I went to that first meeting, and then I listened to the people laugh, and the soul music of Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely our laughter. And I listened to some of the things that they said, although I couldn't hear well, and I was grateful they only gave me a half a cup of coffee. I was very grateful for that, And at the end of the meeting, Buddy, the man who had 12-stepped me, reached across the table, and he patted my hand, and he asked me if there were any questions. Is there anything you want to know about us? And I said, no, I don't have any questions. I just don't want to get drunk anymore. I am sick to death of being drunk. Oh, God. And to this day, I am sick to death of being drunk. The bathe, I was sick of not being able to get dressed. I was sick of not being able to look nice. I was sick of not being able to stand before anybody with my head up and my shoulders back. I was sick of the whole thing. I was sick of it. And I, honest to God, did not want to drink anymore. I just didn't want to drink anymore. And I came to you all. Now, the group that I came to was on the better side of Atlanta. Of course, you wouldn't have expected any less out of me, would you? And I came into that group. Well, the ladies there, and I mean this sincerely, I mean no sarcasm at all, but these ladies really, I didn't quite blend in, let's say. Because these were the gals that lived on the north side of Atlanta and had the nice clothes and the nice, and they talked well. And I had lost all my social skills, people out there. I had lost them all. I did not know how to behave in public anymore. I didn't know how to dress anymore. I didn't know how to act anymore. And I was beginning to feel like maybe I don't belong here. Maybe I have, in fact, sunk too low. Maybe this is not where I'm supposed to be. And I was saddened by that because I really wanted to be. I really wanted to be. And God works so wonderfully, doesn't He? Because He brings this woman who was brave enough to talk to me when I was about 2 weeks sober. And she said to me, there's a group over in Chamblee I think you'd really enjoy. Maybe you ought to try a meeting there. And the woman saved my life because I went to the Atlanta Biscayne Room. And I was 11 days sober. And the room was filled with people like me. They cussed when they talked. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said, I was a very heavy smoker, and I never took my cigarette out of my mouth. I would carry on a conversation with you. I'd be in there, bob up and down. I'd keep right on talking. Ashes would fly in your coffee. I'd keep right on talking. And I got there, and there's a lot of wonderful things that happened, but I don't want to get into too much of this here because I want to talk a lot about what happens when you get sober, but I got into this room, and there were two guys there, and they were godsends, and I mean that in the literal sense of that word. They became my sponsors, and one was Big Jim, and another one we called Dad. His name was Leon, but we called him Dad. And they decided they were going to sponsor me, and I have no idea why. And I have no idea why I elected to listen to these two men. I had never listened to anybody, much less a man, But I do believe that God puts those people into our lives that need to be put into our lives. And He did with those two. And those sponsors back then didn't put up with a lot of crap. They really did. They just didn't, I would go to gym and I'd start this whining and crying. Well, I don't want to do it. And his answer to that was, then get drunk, because that's what we did. These are the steps that we took. And if you don't want to take them, you're going to get drunk. And that's the beginning and the end of it. There was no long discussion. There was no, how do you feel about that? There was either do it or get drunk. And I really think it was wonderful because what he did every time he did that? He put it right back on me, man. Right back on me. It was my responsibility. My sobriety was my responsibility, not his, not the group's. It was mine. And if I wanted to stay sober, I had to quit my whining and quit my crying and do those steps. Now, they knew, too, that I was not a well person, so it wasn't like they started on me right away that I got to work the steps. I firmly believe the first year they were glad that I just kept showing up and breathing. You know, I really think that, because I couldn't comprehend what they were trying to say, but I would listen. I was listening in those meetings, and I was listening to what people would say. And I was very temperamental, and I would get very angry, and sometimes people would say things I didn't agree with. And I just felt it was my obligation to let them know, and I would stand up in the middle of a meeting and cuss them out for all they were worth. And then my sponsor would tell me afterwards that was not acceptable behavior. And I was going to start a fight after in the club room one day. There was one woman, and you know how some people just rub you wrong? Well, she just rubbed me wrong. And I remember I came storming into the room, and she had said one more thing that ticked me off, and I was going to take her out in the parking lot. And Dad was sitting there, and he looked at me, and he said, "Judy, where are you going?" And I said, "You see that broad?" I didn't call her broad, but we'll use that word today. And I said, "I'm going to take her out in the parking lot. I've had it with her mouth, man. It's all the time. And I'm sick of it. That's it. We're going to go outside, take care of it." And Dad said to me, he said, "You get a cup of coffee and sit down." And I detected this was not optional. So I got a cup of coffee and sat down. And Dad was a tiny man in stature. He wasn't very big, a little wiry fellow. If I ever got in a fight, I'd want him on my side. And he took that little finger and he poked it right in my chest and he said, "Judy, if you're going to stay sober, you got to quit hitting people." He said, "Hitting people is not socially acceptable behavior." And I'm sitting there, I'm new. This is news to me. You know, it was socially acceptable where I came from. And then he gave me a gift when he said, "You cannot live like a drunk and expect sobriety." And I knew that. That's when the change had to come. Because I was still thinking like a drunk, and I was still solving things like a drunk in my mind, and I had to change. And change is difficult. Change was difficult. You know, we will stay in misery for the fear of change, won't we? We'll stay uncomfortable because we know that discomfort. We know how to deal with that. And it was frightening. And my sponsors were real good. They did things like they took me out to public places so that I could learn how to behave. Because if I got angry, my voice would raise, and I would use these obscenities. And Jim had a way. I used to accuse him to going to school to learn how to do this. But he would look at me in a look that told me I was not behaving properly. You know? And we'd be out eating, and I'd say something about what somebody had said during the meeting, and my voice would start to raise. And he'd just give me that look. And I knew that I had to bring my voice down, and I wasn't supposed to cuss anymore. He never told me to quit cussing. He just gave me the look. Uh-huh. The other things that my sponsors did that we don't do, and I'm going to tell you, I'm just as guilty as anybody else, we don't do now, and we need to do it if we're going to take the responsibility. My sponsors taught me about how AA works. My sponsors told me what a chairman did. My sponsors told me what a secretary treasurer did in a group. My sponsors told me things about GSRs, about intergroup reps. They told us about those things and how all that worked, and we don't do that like we should. We don't do that, but you know what we do abundantly? We complain because these newcomers don't know what they're doing. You know, so we need to teach them what they're doing. We need to tell them when you share a meeting, this is how we do it at this group. And if you want to change the rules, then you've got to have a group conscience meeting before you change it, not after. We need to tell them these things, not complain about it. You know, and I mean, I've heard a lot of people get upset about profanity. Well, the profanity happens. And a lot of us, that's the only way we knew. That's where we came from. You know, that's where we came from. But I learned from my sponsors by the way they acted. You know, by the interaction I saw them have with the people in the fellowship. I learned how to talk by watching how they talked. See? That's how I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned the big book by the way they lived it. And I had sponsors who lived it. You see, and I got to this program, and I was a 23-year-old woman and addicted to men. And I had a sponsor who had 12 years sobriety, and I had a sponsor who had 8 years sobriety. You know? And a lot of people say a man shouldn't sponsor a woman or vice versa. But let me tell you something. Those two guys had nothing but my best interest at heart. Absolutely nothing but my best interest at heart. I will believe that forever and ever. Forever and ever I will believe that. And if you are a man and you're thinking about working with a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who desperately needs help, you remember you may be the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous she ever gets to know, buddy. So you walk right. You walk right. Do not take advantage of a lame duck. I have sponsored some men in Alcoholics Anonymous, too. I got tickled with one in particular, and I won't use his name because I think he's still around the program, God love him. But I guess he thought that, you know, once a whore, always a whore. And he had a spiritual awakening, let's just put it that way. but you know, once we got that out of the way, he's a terrific guy, and I do truly, he moved away from Atlanta, and I truly do hope that he's still sober, because he did eventually, once we straightened out what the relationship really was supposed to be, and he took his fist up, and the young man had suffered greatly. He had suffered greatly and had a lot of pain, and I was grateful that he did trust me enough to hear that fist step, and it's quite an honor. It's quite an honor. Got into Alcoholics Anonymous and I got married. Well, of course you get married. I mean, that's the decent thing to do. That's what ladies do. They get married. And so I got married. And it doesn't take much to find a husband in Alcoholics Anonymous, actually. It's there's a lot of guys looking for a wife. And so I was 3 months sober and I found, and at 4 months I got married. And he had 5 months sobriety. And we were just the source of entertainment for our home group for about 2 years. Oh, my God, what a whirlwind mess that was, you know, just a chaotic mess. And I will not say anything bad about my ex-husband. The marriage never should have been. Ronnie was one of those guys that you just couldn't help but like. He was a lot of fun. He was just a good old boy, and you just couldn't help but like him. But that's it. Ronnie never grew up, and that's where it went. But we made this brilliant decision based on newcomer thinking that we needed to move to the country because it was the big city that caused all our problems. And so we moved to Hiawassee, Georgia. Now, I have been asphalt and concrete all my life, people. I don't know anything about living in the country. I have no idea. And so I go up there in my, you know, stacked heels that are 4 inches high and my leather suits. And this was back when Hiawassee did not have a lot of folks there. It was all Church of God. And I was still working on my mouth, but I was nowhere near well there either. So I go in the grocery store and ask him to pass me something, and it was not very nice the way I asked him to do that. And people would turn around and stare at me, you know, because I probably used a word they never heard. And it was terrible. It was awful. And I was up there for about 2 years. And I went to meetings there. And I remember how difficult it was for me. The meetings were very small, and I was used to the large meetings in Atlanta. And I saw the same folks every time. And it was hard. And I felt so very alone up there. And the wonderful thing about it that my sponsors had talked to me about was reading, you know, the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsors had told me, too, that, you know, I better get a relationship with God. And I came back with one of those smart quips like, well, I don't want a relationship with God. And, of course, you know what Jim said. Well, then get drunk. So, you know, I had to start a relationship with God. And, by the way, it is in our big book that you need a relationship with God. You will have to have a relationship with God at some time in your sobriety, you know. And I always get tickled at the people that I work with that don't want a relationship with God. And they're standing back and waiting. And then all of a sudden they decide they're going to let God into their lives, and it's like they're expecting a thank you card from God, you know? That's really kind of the way that I was, and I was also fearful because I came into this world a Catholic, and I knew God was going to zap me because of the way I had lived, you know? I remember one time when I was 6 years old, I went to school, and my aunt had painted my fingernails red, and oh my God, the nuns, you know how they can just go berserk at the drop of a hat. So at 6 years old, folks, I was pretty well washed up. I mean, you know, and I kind of felt that. But I started this reading, Came to Believe, and I held on to that book, and I read it over and over and over again. And Came to Believe is a wonderful book because it's one of those things you can sit down, and if you're an anti-alcoholic who isn't really sober, you know, you can read one page and then get up and go do something else. And that's what I did. And I read that book, and eventually there was a relationship with God, and I'll share it with you how that really started. Because I think that's one of the turning points for me in my sobriety, and that my ex-husband and I had a horrible fight that day, and it was a nice day, and we lived up there in those mountains, and not far from our home there was an 8-acre lake, very easy to walk to, and I had dogs. I am an animal lover, and I had 2 dogs at the time, and I took my 2 dogs and walked down there by that lake, and I was crying, and I'd never ever hurt really in sobriety, you know, where it was raw pain against raw nerve. I'd never felt that before, and I wasn't dealing with it well, and I was crying so hard, you know how children cry and they can't get their breath, and that's kind of where I was. And I was thinking, you know, here I go again. It's another mess, man. It's another failure in my life. And one more thing that I didn't do right, and one more thing that I can't get done. And I got a marriage that's going down the tubes, and I just a mess. And I walked down there and sat down next to that lake, and I'm looking up at a mountain, and it sits behind the lake. And I just can remember the feeling so well, and of just looking up there and saying, God, I don't know if you're up there, and I don't know if you can hear me yet. But I got to have some relief or I'll drink again, and I don't want to drink again. And I truly didn't want to drink again. And it was not like God said, okay, Judy, you go from here and this is what you do next. But what happened, people, was there became such a still and such a calm and such a quiet that surrounded me. And it was like there was a good friend sitting next to me, and he had just put his hand on my shoulder and said, you're going to be okay, kid. You're going to be okay. And the reason why that is so important for me to share with you is that you must know that was the first time in my life I was a child of God. I knew no matter what, he heard me. I knew that. I knew that. And I got up from that hillside different. And I can't tell you how, but it was different. For the first time in years, I felt clean. I felt clean. And I knew I was a child of God. Yeah. That's why it is so important for me to let you know, no matter how far down you've gone, you're still a child of God, and he loves you. And if he didn't love you, he wouldn't have brought you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You see? And the marriage broke off, and I went back to Atlanta, and my husband Craig and I we had been friends for a long time, and as a matter of fact, when my ex-husband got drunk one time, he sent Craig over to get me. And so that I could go to the bar and pick him up so he wouldn't get arrested for DUI. Isn't that lovely? And we were good friends, and we started off as good friends. And then when Ronnie and I got divorced, and Craig got divorced from his wife, and neither one of us knew that the other one was filing for a divorce, and we ended up together. And that we were married in 76, and we're still married. And that to me is a miracle. I mean, that to me is a miracle. And I have to thank you. I have to tell you too that, you know, Craig's a big fella. He used to play football, and I am so blessed. I have such a wonderful husband. But sometimes he's very annoying. When we go to conferences like this, periodically, people, and typically it'll be little old ladies will come up to him and pat him on the hand and say, you know, it's just wonderful that you married a woman like you. And you know what ticks me off? Is he stands there and says, thank you. You know, like I jerked him out of a choir somewhere, right? I mean, he was a wino in Pittsburgh, for crying out loud, you know? What? I'm going to tell you about some things about sobriety. And, you know, sometimes when we go to these conferences and the newcomer, they come in on the newcomer. A lot of folks talk about the newcomer. Everything, you know, is directed towards the newcomer. And I know when I was a newcomer, I felt like I had some kind of sexually transmitted disease, for God's sakes, because it was everything that the newcomer. But, that, you know, that is, of course, our life's blood. And I mean no sarcasm by that. It's just that sometimes it's kind of scary that they focus in on you that hard. You know, because I'll tell you, there's a lot of times in sobriety that I have really been hurting, and I really needed Alcoholics Anonymous more, I think, than the newcomer did. You know, because I was really a mess, and there were a lot of times in sobriety when I knew I was sicker than I was when I got here. There was absolutely no doubt in my mind. Well, now I know now, of course, that's not true. But you know, what I had to learn was that I was just aware of how sick I really was when I was sober. So, you know, and there were times in sobriety, and I will tell you that if you're sitting out there right now and you've got between 3 and 5 years of sobriety and you're thinking about killing yourself, you're okay, baby. You are okay. You know, I can remember going to meetings, and I would sit there, and all these people were coming in, and but sometimes they'd be brand new, 90 days, you know, and they got this wonderful job and a brand new car, and they got their family back, and everything's just blissful. And here I am sitting, and I got 5 years, and I got 7 cars, and none of them are running, and, you know, and I'm thinking, what am I doing wrong? I've got to be flunking AA, for crying out loud. I can't even get this thing, you know. But let me tell you something. If you are in that place, and I mean this really, if you are in that place, to where you're thinking about taking your own life, believe it or not, you're getting better. You're getting better, and you know why you're getting better? You're not thinking about drinking. And for the alcoholic, that's what's crucial. That is what's crucial, is you're not thinking about drinking. You know? Now, you need to get with your sponsor, and you need to get with your home group, and you need to do some serious talking. But baby, don't think you're drunk in AA. Sometimes life is just painful. It is just painful. And you know, we learn here how to cope, and we're blessed with that too. Because we have people that we can talk to. We have people that we can take our sick, twisted thoughts to and say, here's what I'm feeling. And they look right at you and say, I know exactly what you mean. You know, I know exactly what you mean. I don't know, with the exception of the fifth step, that Jim spent any more than 15 minutes with me at any given time. I know, but I learned an awful lot from him because I learned the way that he lived. I watched him walk. As I got more involved, when I came back from Hiawassee and I got more involved with the groups, I started doing more with Women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started working with a lot of women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been very blessed this weekend that I have one of my sponsorees that I've been sponsoring for a long time. And she's a sweet and beautiful young woman, and she came to us sweet and beautiful. And Mary, I want you to stand up and say hi to everybody. Just do it. And she's been, we've been able to spend some time together. And you know, that's what's wonderful, you see, is because you do, you pour your heart out on a one-to-one. Now there's things here, of course, from the podium that would be in poor taste for me to share with you. But when I'm sitting down one-to-one and I've got a young woman who's there and she is carrying so much shame, you know, and she really feels like she has absolutely no right to be loved. She just has no right to be loved. And I'm able to tell her that she is one of God's children and look her in the eye and let her know that. You know, then I'm doing what God wants me to do. I am doing what God wants me to do. I will find time to do that. And you know, we need to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you, nothing made me madder, and it still irks me, when somebody is hurting and somebody comes across with a flippant, read your big book and go to meetings. If that's all you got to say, shut up. You know? If you got a drunk in your group that is hurting, take 15 minutes out of your day, sit down, and say, can I help? What can I do? You know, because we got somebody here, and you know how it is, especially when you're under that 5-year period, that some of that pain is gut-wrenching, because we've never been there before. We have never been there before. You know, and we need somebody to say it's okay to hurt. We need somebody to say it's okay to be angry. It's what you do with it. You know, we need somebody, because we don't know. We don't know. You know, and I remember so well the patience that they gave me and the sharing that they gave me. And I remember the laughter, because I laughed a lot. I've reached the stage in Alcoholics Anonymous now, and by the countdown the other night, a lot of us have, where a lot of our friends have gone on to glory now. You know, and they're not here anymore. But I can tell you that every time I get behind a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, Big Jim is on this side and Dad's on this side. Every time. Every time. No. Because they were there. They were there. I've had so many wonderful, rich experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had so many wonderful experiences with the relationship with my mother. Oh, my goodness. Because we have been able to mend our relationship, and it wasn't shortly after I got sober that we started talking. And we started talking about a lot of the things that happened when I grew up. And we started just sharing, and it's been wonderful. And I'll share with you that one day, I guess I was about 10 years sober, and Mom and I were shopping. We were out in Atlanta, just kind of going around the perimeter there. You know, there's a mall every other exit. And we went shopping that day, and the car was quiet. I had taken her out to breakfast, and we were on our way to the next mall. And out of nowhere, absolutely out of nowhere, Mother reaches across the seat, and she pats my shoulder. She said, you're a good daughter, Judy, and you're a good person. Mama loves you very much. And that to me is Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was not allowed in her home. I was never supposed to come back to her home. And it's because of you people that I'm able to do that. And when I do go, she doesn't want me to leave. And that was a rarity. That never happened when I was drinking. I live in Ohio now. We decided we needed to just make some changes and move, and a situation came up, and we took advantage of it. And it's been wonderful. It was a change for me. A lot of different changes, a lot of things go on, you know. And that's part of life, though, isn't it? And I'll get it together here in a minute. People, just be patient with me. It's that mama thing. I've been telling that thing for I don't know how many years, and it chokes me up every time. And I'm so glad to see so many of you out there crying. It just makes me feel good. Anyway, we moved in up to Ohio, and we got this big old farmhouse. Now, you have to understand, my husband's disabled now. My husband's health is very poor, and so he can't work anymore, which is part of the motivation to move as well. And we bought this big old farmhouse at an auction, my house is 125 years old, and we're redoing the house room by room, and I will share my experience with you on that. Don't ever do that. When you hear them say they don't build them like they used to, thank God. We've been there 7 years, and we've got 4 rooms done. The house has a personality, though, you know. Some rooms you walk uphill, some rooms you walk downhill, you know. We have a little cat that we've adopted that's come to live with us, and he loves it because he can get his little ball out, and it always comes back to him, you know, no matter. But I must tell you about where we live because, you know, I love nature and I love animals. I mean, Mary Ellen and I were out on the patio the other day, and I went and got some crackers to feed the birds. They just looked hungry to me, so. And we had fun. It was kind of neat. We threw them up in the air, watched them catch it, and that was nice. That was fun. Those are, you know, God's little reminders that he's here, you know. And back behind the house, we have an Amishman owns 160 acres, and it's all just woods, and it's used a lot as hunting, but it's a great place for the animals. And we have wild turkeys back there and fox and a lot of deer, a lot of deer. And it looks out, my office window looks out over this little meadow that's in the back. There's 2 old apple trees back there. I was getting dressed one morning to go to work, and I looked back out over that little meadow, and there's a doe had brought her 2 fawns down. And it's early summer, and they were still spotted, and they're just beautiful. They're just beautiful creatures. And the bunnies were out feeding. We put food out for them, and they were all around, you know, all of them eating. And curiosity is just, you know, how children are. All children, all God's animals are curious as children. And so there's this little fawn, and he sees this little baby rabbit. And they're watching one another and checking each other out, and they're getting a little closer. You know how they do. They have to check each other out. And they get a little closer, and they get a little closer. Well, before you know it, their noses touch. You know, and I just went berserk. I got Bambi and Thumper in my backyard here. I don't believe this. You know, it was just a sight that was just too precious. And it's glorious, you know, it's just glorious. And there's so much, you know, that God allows us to see and God allows us to love as a result of being sober, as a result of being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, too, that a lot of times in sobriety, I don't act like a sober person. I am not always spiritual. Usually I'm good for a couple hours a week, and that's about it. I remember one time I was still living in Atlanta, I'm in sales. I sell real estate now, but I was selling information systems in Atlanta. And of course, you live in your car, and Atlanta is a terrible place to live in your car. And this was back before I got well, and I used to carry a knife with me, and I had it right next to the car, and I had a tape of Poor Boy Wright in my player, and the tape wouldn't give me the tape back when it was done, and I was not in a good mood. So I got my knife out, and I stabbed my tape player. And I continued to stab that tape player until it gave me my tape back. And then once it gave me my tape back, I stabbed it once again, just for good measure. And when I got home that night, I called a young man that I was sponsoring that fixed things. And I said, "You have to get over here and fix my tape player." And he said, "What happened to it?" And I said, "I stabbed it." And he said, "How long have you been sober, Jude?" And I said, 17 years. He said, "I can't wait to be like you when I grow up, man." A good AA speaker I have been told, will bring comfort to the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. Have you ever heard Father Hilary? God love him. Father Hilary gave me one of my greatest lines, and I've used it for so many years, and I still use it in my everyday life, you know. When he's talking about why are we alcoholic? What made us an alcoholic? And he asked that at one of his very first meetings. And they said, it doesn't matter how the jackass got in the ditch, just get him out. And so many times in my life I've had to look at that. You know, it doesn't matter how I got here, I just got to get out of what I'm doing. When Craig got so very ill, he came home from work one day, and this was the long and the short of it. He came home from the doctor's one day, and he said to me, Jude, the doctor has said I can't work for at least a year and probably a year and a half. Now, we had worked our way up. We had the home in the suburb. We had two new cars. We had the things that you acquire when life moves on and when you're living right. And all of a sudden, that kaboom went in half. Shortly thereafter, I made a job move. And what in essence happened is we moved from making $100,000 a year to $20,000 a year. And you just cannot survive that kind of a fall. And we had to file for bankruptcy, and that was real difficult. But you know, that's part of life, and those things happen. And you see, Alcoholics Anonymous does not necessarily mean that you come in here and you stay happy, joyous, and free all your life. That's not what this means. That's not what it has meant to me. What it has meant to me is that I can deal with no matter what comes down the pipe. Man, I don't have to drink. I don't have to drink. And I will remind you too, please, that nowhere in the big book does it say you have to do this thing graciously. All right? We just have to do it. You know, because there have been times when I have been bitter about being sober. There have been times when I did not like Alcoholics Anonymous, when I did not want to talk to you about my issue. I didn't want to talk about anything. I wanted you just to leave me alone. And it doesn't say I have to do it gracefully. It doesn't say that. You know, some days, honey, all you can do is just not drink. That's some days, that's the best you're going to do, and be grateful for that. Be grateful for that. You know, it's okay to have those days because you're human. And sometimes I think we forget that we're human. And not every day is going to be a cakewalk. Not every day. Some days are just difficult. But you open yourself up to others. And it's in giving of love and service, as all of the other speakers have mentioned, that you forget about yourself. And you forget about your needs. And you forget about your pain. And what is glorious about Alcoholics Anonymous is we can take this out into the world. God knows they need it. You know, we can take what we learn here out there and share with them. And share with them that we turn things over to God. You know, and share with them that the best way to get out of self is to help others. You know, and I've been able to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very, very grateful. I am very grateful. I am going to close with a passage I frequently read. And that too is one that y'all can just look up. I typically don't read to them, but for some reason I'm supposed to today, so I'm going to. And it says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you all for your attention.